Let me ask you a question. Have you made any mistakes in your investment career? Now, if you're an investor, you've almost certainly made some mistakes. Nobody starts off being a great investor. Property investment is a learned skill. And today I'm going to share with you one of the biggest mistakes I made. I made it early on in my investment career, and it's indisputable proof that I began life as an investment sucker. Today's show is part of what I'm calling the Summer Series, where we replay some of the best episodes of the past. Remember, throughout January, I'm going to be bringing you three shows a week rather than the normal two shows a week. And the reason I'm keen for you to listen to today's show is because I hope you'll learn something from the big mistake I made. You see, I was taken in by a spruiker. Now, it's almost 50 years that I've been an investor, and nobody's made more mistakes in the investment journey than I have. In fact, I've often said I'm a real success at failure. And I'm also a very successful property investor today, and that's largely because I've learned from my mistakes. So, as I said, I hope you learn from the one I'm going to be sharing with you today, made early in my investment journey, where I lost 100% of my invested capital. And that was only one of the many learning fees I paid to the market over the years. Subsequently, I made lots of mistakes, and I paid lots of learning fees along the way. And that's one of the reasons I share these regular podcasts with you, to help you avoid the mistakes, the common mistakes investors make. Now, the mistake I'm going to share with you today was made in the early 1970s, but the lesson's just as relevant today because now that our property cycle has entered a new stage, there are plenty of sharks out there. There are lots of property spruikers out there, and they've got a vested interest. And it's not to help you. They haven't got your best interest at heart. So I hope you enjoy our chat as I expose a few things about my past. Then I'm going to have a talk with Pete Borgent about three demographic trends that you need to understand as a property investor. Now, remember, this is a replay of an episode, the whole show, that we recorded a couple of years ago. Yet the information is timeless, but it'll be interesting to see how the comments we made then about demographics well before coronavirus in 2020 are relevant today. However, I believe that long-term trends, the trends that Peter and I are going to talk about, are just as relevant today as they were back then. And you've heard me say it before, you should be investing with the long term, with the big picture in mind, rather than paying attention to the short term fads. And of course, I've always got a mindset message for you in my shows, and no different today. So welcome to today's episode of the Michael Yardney Podcast.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropole, who specialize in helping you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now, here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
One of my early investments was a complete loss. And so today I'd like to share the story of my worst investment loss ever. Now, I know it doesn't make for ego-pleasing conversation from me, from somebody who's meant to be an investment expert, but it's the truth. However, I'm keen to tell you the story of how I lost 100% of my invested capital many years ago. This was way back in the 1970s, and I want to share with you the investment mistakes I made that created this disastrous result. But first, I want to explain to you the two main reasons I'm sharing this story. Firstly, losing investments can make great teachers. You're not only going to learn from the investment mistakes you make, but you can also learn from others' investment errors so that you won't make the same mistakes yourself. Most property investors pay the market a huge learning fee in the way of mistakes. Studies show that around 50% of those who get into property investment sell up in the first 5 years. Clearly, they've done something wrong. And a lot of those who stay in property investment never get the financial freedom they deserve. They never get past their first or second property. So they're making mistakes. So why not learn how to avoid their common mistakes? The second reason I want to share this story is to explain to you that losses are a natural and normal result of making investment decisions. So don't be hard on yourself when things don't go as planned, because the key to long-term success is what you do when these things do go wrong, what happens, the lessons you learn from your mistakes so you don't repeat them. The problem is many investors just seem to keep repeating the same bad investment behaviours. So here's the story of my big investment mistake when I lost 100% of my investment capital. Now, okay, go ahead, you can laugh at my foolishness. Yeah, I should have even known better then. You see, I'd already owned a couple of investment properties at the time, but I was in a hurry to get rich quick. Interestingly, I guess this story is good evidence that I wasn't born a great investor. It's evidence that investment's a learned skill, and I hope the lessons contained in it are going to help you avoid the mistakes I made. You see, I was offered the opportunity of investing in a gold mine. In fact, one of my friends, Brian, had invested the vast sum of $5,000. Now remember, that was back in the 1970s, and $5,000 was a lot of money then. He invested that into a venture that was going to resurrect an old, disused gold mine in Wedderburn near Ballarat in Victoria. Of course, my initial reaction was to tell him how silly he was, how he's going to lose his money. But Brian asked me to speak to the promoter, explaining that he told a compelling story. So I did. And I still remember the story well. I can picture it in my mind's eye, how a man called Terry came to our home on a Sunday morning and described how, with the price of gold now having risen and the new technology they had available, it was now viable to open up an old disused mine near Ballarat, you know, where the gold rush was way back in the 1800s. And he had budgets and profit projections and diagrams and plans. But things changed. Things changed when he pulled out of his pocket a shiny gold nugget and he placed it in my hand. I don't think I'd ever seen gold before. I'd never held gold before. And he then told me a compelling story of how I could double my money quickly investing in his company. It was called Asian Pacific Mining Corporation. Boy, was that an impressive name to me at the time. And he told me how I was going to make money quickly and then receive dividends for years. And my greed glands began working overtime as I swallowed his story. Hook, line, and sinker. The end result was I invested $5,000 of my money. And of course, I lost it all. Now, just to put things in perspective, in those days, the family car was the Holden Kingswood, and that cost around $2,000. So $5,000 was a lot of money in those days. What happened was that my money and that of all the other investors was squandered by Terry into frivolous startup costs. I think he even bought or hired a helicopter, I can't remember, but it all went away and there was nothing left to invest in the mines. Looking back, my investment decision was one big mistake from the beginning. So here are a few of the more obvious mistakes I made with this investment. First of all, I gave my money to a virtual stranger without doing due diligence. Sure, my friend Brian and a few other friends had already invested with him, but I didn't really look at the so-called opportunity enough. Of course, it was much harder in those days. There wasn't the internet to do research on. The second mistake I made was I invested in something I just didn't understand. I bought the story rather than the investment fundamentals. Another mistake was I guess I was lured by the opportunity of making quick money. I guess what happened really was I was speculating, not investing, and I risked money at that stage I couldn't afford to lose. Another mistake was I just didn't have an investment strategy. I just wanted to get rich quick. Now, I learned many lessons from this experience, including, first of all, not everything that glistens is gold. Number two, sometimes your best investments are the ones you don't make. I know since then, I've actually learned to say no to more opportunities that come up than yes, and I've made more money by saying no to them. Another lesson, an important lesson, is don't invest in anything you don't understand. I knew nothing about gold mining, so really I was speculating, I wasn't investing. I had no competitive advantage. There was no mathematical expectation to my investment strategy. Another lesson, and it took me years to learn this one, was that one of the worst things that can happen to an investor is to get it right first time. I thought I was smarter than I was, when in reality, my investment success up to that point was because of a rising market, a boom that made me look smarter than I was. So over the years, I learned don't become overconfident because the market's soon going to humble you. And another lesson was I didn't really understand the incentives that this so-called advisor had, because really he had a vested interest and that created biases in the recommendations he made to me. Now, I could add lots more mistakes to this list, but I think you get the point. Looking back, one other mistake I should mention that occurred after the event was blaming outside factors for my investment failure rather than evaluating what really happened and owning up to my own failures. You see, the mistake then was a big blow to my ego. I had to explain the loss to my then wife. It was embarrassing, but it provided me the opportunity to learn some great lessons. So my question to you is, how many of the above mistakes, the ones I just mentioned, are you making? How much are your investment mistakes costing you? One of the key factors that has led to my investment success is that I always try and learn from my mistakes. In my early years of investing, I tried to constantly improve my skills by studying any loss that I'd made or examining any property that didn't perform as well as it should have. I wanted to understand what was wrong with my strategy, and then I set up disciplines to ensure I didn't make the same mistake again. And this has led to my now proven, time-tested investment strategies that take the emotion out of the investing. It's my top-down approach that I've discussed in previous podcasts. It's my six-stranded strategic approach. They're the approaches my team at Metropole use when discussing investment strategies with our clients. That's what we do to make sure that we always buy properties that are going to outperform in the long term and not let emotion or short-term factors get in the way. So in retrospect, my worst investment decision was a cheap lesson. Now, of course, this investment was the first of many learning fees I've paid to the market over the years. I've made lots of mistakes and I've paid lots of learning fees during my journey to investment success. Probably not many in the last 10, 15 years, but boy, have I made my share of mistakes. But it's much easier today, nowadays, for beginning investors, that things I wasn't able to tap into in the past, because you don't need to do it on your own anymore. There are plenty of good independent property strategists out there to help you. That wasn't the case when I was investing. And I guess that's one of the reasons I formed Metropole many, many years ago. And now we've been involved in over $3 billion worth of property transactions, helping clients create their wealth. That's why we're managing $2 billion of our clients' assets in our property management department. But unfortunately, there are still many sharks out there too. Now, maybe they don't have the unethical intentions Terry had, but they've got vested interests. They tend to represent builders or developers, but they're disguising themselves as advisors or buyer's agents when they're really representing somebody else and not you. So what about you? What can you learn from my story? Are you making any of these investment mistakes? Are you using any of these excuses to dismiss your investment losses as not reflecting a fundamental flaw in your strategy? As I said right at the beginning of this article, every investor makes mistakes. It's okay. It's a normal part of the investment journey. But to minimize them and to maximize your investment results, you need to treat your property investments like a business and critically evaluate each of your property's performance. Look, all too often I see investors holding on to underperforming properties in the hope that one day they're going to come good. And you know what they often say? In fact, they almost always say, that's okay, this property is going to go up in value one day and it doesn't matter because it's not costing me anything at the moment. Wrong. It is. What they're losing out on is opportunity cost, the opportunity of owning better investment properties. Think about it. If you can only own three or four properties, then you must own the best three or four properties you can afford. So it's your job as a property investor to accept responsibility for how your property investments are performing and figure out what's making them perform well, and I hope they are, or what's underperforming so you can rectify the issues and avoid the same errors in the future. Taking responsibility for your investments performances is the first step to improving your investment strategy to become a consistently profitable investor, not just of luck. You want to be able to do it consistently. And remember, again, nobody starts out as a great investor. Property investments are a learned skill. But now you've got undisputed proof that I started out as an investment sucker. Few people have made more mistakes in the investment journey than I did. Maybe it's because I'm getting on in age now and I've done it for well over 40 years. In fact, I've said I'm a real success at failure. Yet today I'm a very successful investor, largely because I've learned from my mistakes. And I hope you're learning something from my mistakes as well. So what can you do next? If you're looking for independent advice in these challenging markets, if you're looking for somebody to help you move forward, why not have a chat with the team at Metropole? We've got no properties for sale and our strategists are independent. So we'll evaluate how your current portfolio is performing and we'll do some numbers and spreadsheets to see what's likely to happen in the future. That's part of the strategic property planning that we do to understand, are your goals realistic? Are you able to achieve them? What sort of cash flow could you need? So Remember, our multi-award winning team have, as I said, have no properties for sale, so we're unbiased. So whether you're a beginner and don't want to make the mistakes so many other beginners make, or you're a seasoned property investor and you just want to make sure you're on the right track and see where you're heading, we'd love to help you formulate an investment strategy and do a review of your existing portfolio, help you take your investments to the next level. So go to metropole.com.au or give us a call on 1300 Metropole, metropole.com.au, and let me and my team be part of your investment journey.
Now here's Michael's mindset message. Remember, a change in your thinking will lead to a change in your life.
In my mindset message this week, I'd like to share with you five questions that could change your life. Look, as you've noticed, I mentioned in my writing in my podcasts a lot that self-awareness is a prerequisite to change. So if your life's not what you expected it to be and you don't know why, self-awareness holds the key. Self-awareness forces you to discover the truth about yourself. Unfortunately, most of us avoid thinking about what it really is that we are, why we are the way we are. Without self-awareness, you're never going to be able to understand why your life is the way it is. So I wanted to share with you some ideas that may confront you, that may confront your inner demons, things that are holding you back. So I've devised five questions to ask yourself that'll help you better understand why you are where you are. The first question is, who are my mentors? Mentors are the fast track to success. Those who seek out and find mentors to help them learn, help them grow, to help them do what they need to do, they're the ones that excel. Those who don't, flounder. Now, have you ever sought out a mentor? Do you have any mentors right now? Now, some of you are saying, yes, I'm part of Michael Yardney's mentorship program, or I've joined other mentors, or I'm part of a mastermind. And others of you are probably saying, no, I don't have any at the moment. But the answer is you do. You don't necessarily recognize it, but the mentors are the people that you hang around with, that you learn habits from. So yes, you have got mentors. Choose them really, really carefully. The second question you should ask yourself is, do I have any toxic relationships? Because toxic people drag you down. They demotivate you. They antagonize you. They anger you. They interrupt your life. And they add little value to your life. They're typically negative people. They tend to gossip. They're naysayers who stop you in your tracks. Boy, are there people out there who are property pessimists, the glass half empty people all the time, who stop you achieving your goals and dreams. They actually stop you even pursuing them, so you can't ever achieve them. They consume the limited amount of time and resources that you've got. So the fewer toxic relationships you've got in your life, the better your life's going to be. The third question I'd like you to ask yourself is, how much self-study do I do every day? Daily self-improvement causes growth. You've heard it over and over again in my chats with Tom Cawley, how successful people continuously improve themselves with self-education. Self-motivated, successful people pursue learning every day in order to grow, to become the person that they want to become, to find more success. So, do you read every day? But do you read for learning rather than for leisure? Do you write down what you learn? Do you have a growth mindset? The fourth question I'd like you to ask yourself is, what are you passionate about? Those who pursue things they're passionate about accumulate the most wealth in life. They tend to be the most successful people. So what makes your heart sing? And are you pursuing things you're passionate about? What are your dreams? What are your stretched goals? What are you going to go for? And the last of the five questions I'd like to share with you in this mindset moment is, how many hours do you waste every day? The hallmark of successful people is their productive use of time. They devote hours to self-study, as I've mentioned. They network with other success-minded people. They pursue their dreams. They chase their goals. They develop a blueprint for their lives and devote hours every day following their blueprint. Now, that doesn't mean they don't have fun. That doesn't mean there's not time for leisure. And you do have to have a balance with your family and your friends. Can't all be work. But if you're not where you want to be in life at present, Just ask yourself those five questions. Who are my mentors? Do I have any toxic relationships pulling me down? How much do I study every day? How much do I read every day? What am I passionate about? And the big one is, how many hours do I waste every day? Now, if you've got an iPhone, there's that screen time app that every week comes and tells you how much time you're spending on your phone and where. That's very telling, isn't it? I hope you got something out of this mindset message this week. You probably have heard me say it before, but I believe the demographic changes that are occurring in Australia are going to be more important to the shape of our property markets and which properties are going to be more valuable than others than the ups and downs of interest rates or government policies in taxes. So demographics drives our property markets. And today I've got with me Pete Wargent, a CPA financial planner who actually has retired to live off his property portfolio. He's just not a theorist, but he's a doer. And I see him as a bit of a futurist because I know his views of what's going to happen in Australia moving forward are very well recognised by the media. So welcome, Pete.
Hi, Michael. It's good to be back on.
Now, Pete, what do you think will be some of the major influences that are going to shape the property markets of Australia moving forward?
Oh, well, I think, as always, demographics is destiny. And I think the biggest, the number one trend over the past couple of decades, really, has just been the growth of technology. And it's changing the way that we live. It's changing the way that we work. And it's changing the way that we earn money and build wealth as well. So I think if there are lots of smaller drivers, of course, but that is the number one big change in the economy for me.
Well, we understand that property is a game of finance and therefore people who can afford to pay more for their homes, we tend to think as investors, but basically it's homeowners that drive the markets. So people who can afford to pay more will often spend more, upgrade, build their bigger houses and or renovate properties. So I like looking for areas that are gentrifying and areas where wages growth is growing higher or disposable income is growing higher, which is a byproduct of wages growth than the average for the state. But it seems like some jobs are going to disappear. In fact, I've heard studies suggesting that 30, even 40% of the jobs currently available in Australia won't be around in 2030.
Yeah, certainly in their current form. And that's what, I mean, people have warned about this for decades. It's the rise of automation and technology. It makes some jobs obsolete or it sends them offshore. So car manufacturing is a good example. In Australia, we used to make cars here. Now it's done elsewhere because it's cheaper. So that will continue and it could well gather pace as well. But one of the positive things about capitalism is that it always creates new things for us to do and new jobs. So it's not necessarily a doomsday scenario, but you might find the wages growth that we used to get used to, 5 or 10%. On average, now we're seeing wages growth much lower, but instead we're seeing this concentration of wealth. And I think it's partly due to technology. It's also accentuated in Australia because we don't have punitive death duties. So where I'm from in Britain, 40% of your money goes straight to the government when you die, but not so in Australia. So we tend to find that the more affluent areas are becoming more and more exclusive.
So when I was saying the jobs are going to disappear, I agree with you. I don't think there's going to be a 30, 40% unemployment rate. Just have a look at what happened in Victoria, where, as you correctly say, the car manufacturing industry disappeared. And there were pundits out there saying that it was going to create recession in Victoria and our property markets in Geelong and were going to be decimated. In fact, it's been one of the strongest property markets in Australia when the rest of Australia had a downturn. So people will be redeployed and find other jobs. But as you say, those jobs won't necessarily be as highly paid. So I think fewer people will be doing the same sort of jobs. But this will affect what people can afford to pay. So with fewer higher-paying jobs, it's likely that the outlying areas and the working-class areas, and this is not a judge of people, but it really is just a sign of their income, it's going to be harder to see strong property price growth there if people aren't having higher wages, Pete.
No, and in fact, in many areas, certainly in Sydney, and you would know better than me, but presumably in Victoria and Melbourne as well, prices in some of those lower socio-demographic areas actually got ahead of themselves in the period of low interest rates driven by investors. But you take away the investor demand, as we saw in the past couple of years, probably some quite painful correction there. But if you want sustainable property price growth and outperformance, well, it has to come from higher wealth and higher earnings over time. So that's why you always recommend looking for those outperforming areas where there's a scarcity of land and it's close to the highest paying jobs, which I believe in the future will be more driven by the big tech companies. That's what we've seen in the US, and I'm pretty sure it'll be the same in Australia too.
Well, 2 points that come from what you just said. Yes, there was a ripple effect out. So as the property values increased in the middle and inner ring suburbs of our capital cities, yes, the outer suburbs did change. The other thing that changed was the nature of the properties that were built there. Lots of apartments were built in suburbs where the nature of the demographic was they didn't particularly want apartments. They lived out there because they wanted big front and backyards. And I know some of the investors who bought out there are now very, very much regretting it as the ripple effect has reversed and actually those property values have dropped more than the inner ring suburbs. But it's very likely that people are going to come to Melbourne in particular, Melbourne and Sydney, I should say, in particular, and Southeast Queensland and Brisbane a bit as well, for the higher paying jobs. And that's where the wealthy people are going to still keep congregating in the inner and middle ring suburbs. The trouble is a lot of the new accommodation being built there is the wrong accommodation. We don't want all those high-rise towers. They're not built for families. So even though a quarter of Australians are going to be living in apartments or already close to that anyway, they're not building the right apartments for what we need, Pete.
No, that's right. You generally find when people are analysing this stuff, they take what is happening over the past week or the past month or past 3 months and they just extrapolate that forward. But as you know, property markets over any meaningful period of time are always driven by supply and demand. So what you really want to invest in is stuff that is scarce, so either more medium density or family appropriate property or accommodation, and in particular in those areas, striking distance to the city, 10, 12 minutes. You know, those are the kind of areas that will outperform over time. It's just that we've had a tricky year or two because access to credit has been so much tighter than it was.
Now, we're building much of the wrong stuff, but unfortunately, it's also clogging our roads. So our population in Australia is growing at about 1.5, 1.6% per annum. In Melbourne, it's growing at 2.3%, I think, in the last year, which means in the next 4 years, Melbourne's population is going to increase by 10%. Where are we going to put 10% more cars in Melbourne, 10% more cars in Sydney, Brisbane over the next 5 or 6 years, in Melbourne in the next 4 years? So transport and infrastructure is going to be an issue. That's already been seen overseas. What happens when cities become big, get over 5 million, for example, Pete, like Melbourne and Sydney already are?
Well, that's been the global experience, is that livability just suddenly becomes much more challenging once cities go beyond about 5 million. Now, Sydney's gone beyond 5.3. Melbourne will be catching it pretty soon. So we'll see more and more media pieces, no doubt, over the next couple of years about people lack of productivity because people are spending too long in the car on the way to work. We'll see demand for housing will shift quite quickly, I think, towards areas with better public transport, particularly train, because people will just, they will eventually reach, don't want to be spending 2 or 3 hours a day in the car. So I think that'll be a big change for the property market. Now, Brisbane is a lot further behind on that curve, but if you get out of work too late and get stuck in the rush hour, it can cost you, a very long period of time to get home because everybody still drives everywhere in Brisbane.
Yes, they do, but it gives them a really good chance to listen to the Michael Yardley podcast. Having said that, a while ago, every location in Australia, every property was ranked by an organisation called WalkScore, and you can go to walkscore.com.au and you'll actually be able to see locations ranked by WalkScore, from 100 being very walkable to at the other end being not walkable. Now, if you happen to walkable, meaning easy, how easy it is to access various amenities, and you can actually see they've got a little map there showing you how long it takes to get to various places. Now, some people choose to live in non-walkable locations, so they actually want to live in regional Australia. They want to have a little bit of isolation. They want to be able to ride their horses or walk their dogs, and there's no issue with that. But for more and more of us, we're going to want proximity to amenities, and it's been shown that there's a number of health benefits from doing that, and there's actually been increased property values in properties which have got a better walk score. And I know in England, back where you originally came from, proximity to the tube made a big difference in the increasing value of properties.
Yes, certainly did, and for rentals as well, actually. So in regional areas, not so much. People still drive in regional areas in Britain, but yeah, years ago in London, people just gave up on the idea of car ownership or driving everywhere, and everybody wants to be near a tube station. So that's the way, particularly Sydney and Melbourne, are heading. People will they will live close to their work, ideally, and if they've got a train connection, that will be particularly good. And I'm just looking at some of those commercial property trends that we've seen just in the past couple of years. So Amazon is going to put its head office in at Market Street in Sydney. Google is hoovering up most of Pyrmont at the moment with its commercial space. We've already seen Apple, of course, in Sydney CBD. And there'll be similar trends in Melbourne as well. So those are the kind of areas where the real high earning and high wealth concentrations will be. So people will just want to be within a striking distance or walking distance in some cases of some of those areas.
Well, another trend clearly is that more of us are trading our backyards for balconies or courtyards, and we're going to be spending more time in the cafes, in the restaurants, rather than entertaining at home like we used to years ago as well. And the fact that more Australians are living on their own, 22% of Australians apparently currently are living on their own, but they want the opportunity to stroll down to their favourite cafe or have a meal. So when looking at buying your next investment, or in fact even your next home, I think considering proximity to amenities is going to be more and more important. And walk score is one of the things that most people don't actually check on or click on, but it's a free report that you can get. It's just one of the many things you've got to put in the mix, Pete.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, look at a suburb like, I don't know, just to pick one example, somewhere like Surrey Hills in Sydney. Some years ago, you know, it was a bit rough around the edges in part. Look at it now. It's got everything you need. Light rail coming close to the city. There's a real limit on the amount of rental stock. The vacancies are always very, very low. It's just going to create a pressure cooker on property prices.
Now, interestingly, a number of studies have shown that there are health benefits living in the inner suburbs and the more walkable suburbs, and actually health problems living in the outer suburbs. A study by the University of Melbourne, a 10-year study, found that walkable neighbourhoods with proximity to shops, parks, public transport, improve people's health and well-being. But I remember a while ago reading a couple of studies that the outer suburbs, where there wasn't as much public transport, there wasn't as much amenity, people's lifestyles weren't as good, weren't as healthy, they had more illnesses, more diabetes, more chronic illnesses, Pete.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a skeptic when it comes to surveys, and I suppose you might say, well, to some extent, that's probably to do with the demographic mix. So you often find that wealthier or higher paid people are maybe more health conscious. You know, I mean, I used to live in Pyrmont myself for many years, and you can easily fall into that lifestyle of eating takeaway food. But I mean, look at it these days. I mean, you've got farmers markets, you've got vegan restaurants, you've got the gym on your doorstep, and you can walk to work. So there's lots going for it.
Fantastic. So some interesting changes moving ahead. It's important to take demographics into account when you're looking for your next investment property. So as Pete said right at the beginning, demographics drives our markets. Now, Pete, I love reading your blogs. You've got lots of information, regular graphs. Every day you come up with something clever. If people want to find out more about your blogs, your content, or your coaching program, how do they find out about you?
Well, my daily blog, you can see at Pete Wargent Blogspot. So that's petewargent.blogspot.com. And if you're interested in my coaching program, it's gonextlevelwealth.com.au. And there's loads of free content there for you.
There is lots of good stuff and lots of good short videos as well. Thanks for being on the Michael Yardney podcast once again, Pete.
Pleasure. It's always good fun.
Well, I hope you learned lots in today's show. It was interesting just thinking back all those years ago, how silly I was. Fortunately, I don't make too many mistakes, not in my investments anyway, but I still do it, obviously, in other areas of my life. And great to speak with Pete Wargent. Now, if you got some benefit from this, if you learned something about it, if it's going to help you in the future, please share the experience with others. I'm trying to help as many people as possible become more financially fluent. And at the bottom of every podcast app, there's a share button. Tell somebody about it. And it's also great when you leave reviews. I read them out, and when yours is read out, like I'm going to do for Chester Box, who left me a review on Apple Podcasts, and you email me at michael@metropole.com.au, I'd love to gift you one of my books as a way of saying thank you. And Chester Box wrote, 3 weeks ago I found this podcast, and I've been listening to this every day. As someone who's looking for guidance and advice on how to become wealthy and fulfilled, the Michael Yardney podcast is the real deal. The information is incredibly rich and inspiring. Listening to him makes it easy to believe that I can reach my goals too. And the answer, Chester Box, is you can, because if others have been able to achieve something, so can you. What we're talking about with money, wealth, finance are learned skills. We learn some rich habits and poor habits from our parents and our early mentors in life. And I'm trying to undo some of that and teach you some good stuff. So stay on track, keep listening, and keep me up to date with how you're going. Similarly, if you'd like to learn more yourself, why not subscribe to propertyupdate.com.au, my daily newsletter, where a whole heap of experts teach you about property, money, finance, tax, and success. And twice a week, I'll be back with new episodes of the Michael Yardney podcast. In the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney podcast, which was brought to you by Metropole, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropole to help you?